Hi, I'm Alex, your host, and this is Knock at World Radio, in which I travel the world to meet the most interesting people in the knock at space. In spring 2022, we decided with some members of the French knock at community to go spend a month in Lisbon, in Portugal. We designed a project called the Knock at House. We rented a big flat, and basically the idea was to host French knockers from the community to come work together, you know, in a co-living type situation, and then at night we would do live streams on Twitch and these kind of things. This is all in French. You can have a look on the French YouTube channel, the Knock at France channel. And this was the opportunity for me to travel a bit. As you might know, I try to avoid taking the plane in Europe. So I looked, and it was not an easy thing to do, but I figured out a way to go from Paris to Lisbon by train and bus. And so the first step of this was to stop in Barcelona. In Barcelona, I knew there would be some interesting knockers, and I got in touch with Toby Oliva from Bravo Studio, a well-known tool in the knockout space. And I was very curious and eager to have a chat with him, because some of the people from the French knockout community had a chance to talk with him. And I'm also quite interested and fascinated by what they are doing at Bravo. So he accepted, and so here we are, having a chat with Toby. This is episode 1 of the first season of the Knock at World Radio podcast. Hi Toby, thanks for meeting me here in sunny Barcelona. So you're the CEO of Bravo Studio, a very innovative knock at tool, and you previously were the CTO of another well-known knock at tool, Typeform. Can you tell me a bit about yourself and what led you to here?
Which led me to which bit? I had my own startup in the UK a few years ago, and then I came to Barcelona, and I joined Typeform pretty early on. And I think part of me wanted to come to Barcelona because it was really because of the city and the weather as I wanted to come here, and then I managed to find an amazing place to work, and I learned a huge amount from being at Typeform. So an amazing success story for Barcelona.
Yes, you have a very technical background.
I've worked in the technical side of banks, IBM research labs, a whole ton of different places. My education is from engineering background.
Cool. Just before we start talking about Bravo, how was it to work at Typeform, and for you, what makes it so popular?
It was a super fun experience. Typeform had an amazing culture and had an amazing product. I mean, the founders were super focused on design and helping people, allowing people to make great looking forms. I mean, really, Typeform came from this idea of conversation data collection. So you'd rather than shouting at people that are demanding information from them, it was much more of a conversation. And that meant that people were much more open to sharing their information. I think that there used to be a statistic that was thrown around that Typeform would get 3 times the response rate of other forms because of the way it was laid out. And I think partly was this conversation, one question at a time, but it was also about the design. A lot of thought went into how it looked and how it worked. And that meant there was a lot of love for the product. And what would happen, that created a very viral nature, because often when you're completing Typeforms, you would, you'd see how it was made, and then you want to use it yourself. So when you send out 20 forms, those 20 people then send another 12 forms. And so you had this viral growth pattern of acquisition, which was incredibly valuable from a sort of growing startup perspective.
Nice. You started Bravo Studio. When was that? A few years ago?
It was 2019. So 3 years, almost 3 years ago.
What was the trigger for that?
So, I mean, it was a combination of things. So one of the things I'd been thinking about at Typeform was this idea of going beyond. I mean, so Typeform, when I was at Typeform, we pushed out the APIs, so we get the connections that Typeform could work with other tools. And it was, that gave us this idea of creating a UI for APIs, going beyond just data collection, but could you actually create something that could just leverage APIs to build an application and just create the UI to do that. So that was kind of an idea I had. And then I came across a mobile team that had been building some tools. And actually, mobile is probably the hardest sort of thing to develop for. And you've got to develop for both iOS and Android. There's a lot of restrictions. You've got to do the builds. It's quite painful. You know, it's getting much easier and easier to develop for JavaScript. It's much more, I mean, you know, going back a few years, JavaScript was hugely fragmented with different browsers. But now you've got a very sort of unified platform to develop for. So it's much easier, and some really good tools like Webflow, even the Wix and Spice. There's great tools for making websites and connecting to things. But in mobile, we're not quite there yet. So it felt like trying to do something in mobile, doing something about connecting APIs to UI, and that's really where Bromberg came from.
And maybe you can explain what it is now. Like, what's really the product? It's not very easy on a podcast. It's a very visual tool.
Really, what Bravo is trying to do is to help people take a design through to something that can be used. So what Bravo will do is it will take a Figma or an XD, or Adobe XD, set of wireframes, and convert it into a native application that gets its functionality via APIs. So that's two ways, not just content, but also you can interact with it. We can, you know, in Bravo, you can basically say a text field is an input field that people can write in that will then connect to an API. And so what that means is you can iterate really fast, and you can, you can go very quickly from your design to something that can be used and tested with users. And, you know, what we find is that nearly always people, when they're looking at building a mobile application, will be putting them into some sort of design tool to kind of figure out how the layout. So actually, it's a very small jump with Bravo to actually get something that you can actually use. And as we add more and more functionality, what we're finding is people are going, you know what, I don't need to develop anymore. I can just use this. The Bravo can actually, the prototype is something I can use. And that's partly because Bravo's got a lot of functionality in terms of the components that it provides, but also because it's running on a mobile device, the scaling part comes from the back end, not from the mobile. So you don't have to worry about the fact that you're going to hit limits on what it can handle, because that's what the back end is doing, and not the actual mobile piece. So really, what Bravo enables you to do is not really change your workflow. It just short circuit the workflow. I mean, normally, if you imagine that the product owner and the UI designer sitting down fleshing out how it would look, and you know, at that point when they would hand over to devs, you could hand over to Bravo and be done. So that's really what we're trying to do is to kind of short circuit that and take away a lot of the sort of boilerplate that the devs would be doing, and so they can focus on the core functionality of the business.
It's interesting because this handover situation is I think one of the most problematic thing in the dev industry. I mean, I'm originally a dev, and I know it was very frustrating for designers when they see like what was implemented and all this.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just a strength for everybody. Devs hate it, designers hate it. I mean, if you have Envision, which was a $1 billion company based around trying to resolve that handover process. So, you know, if you can kind of make it easier and let the designers see exactly what they're making, and so, you know, and let the devs focus on the functionality rather than the exact design detail, hopefully it'll make everyone happier.
Definitely. Now, it's interesting because you provide another solution. Because, for instance, Webflow is also trying to address this situation, but they address it by giving the power to the designer to program their website, but just without the backend part, you've been frustrating with your front-end developers, do it yourself. What you're doing is much more, from what I understand, generic in a way. It's like replace this.
I think if you think about it, what we're doing is we're doing a similar thing, but we're just not doing the design piece. We're allowing to bring it in from the existing tools. So rather than you having to export from Figma to Webflow and then building it, just do it directly in Figma. I think there's an analogy with what we're doing with Webflow, because we're not trying to do the backend piece. We're just trying to help people deliver that.
Yeah.
But it's we're just kind of opening it up a bit and let you work in the tool that you know the best. So rather than you having to figure out how do I do that to move those layers around in Webflow, if you've done in Figma, you're done. Yeah. So it's trying to help you know, make it a bit easier to get through. I mean, look, all these things, there are trade-offs. You know, the challenges we have in Bravo is how, you know, making it so that the Bravo knows exactly what your ideas are for the design. And so we have this idea of tags where you annotate the design, say like this screen is a menu and this graphic is an icon that will be used for the application. So we have a few annotations to help with that process. So there is some learning, Bravo. I wasn't just going to be magically makes everything every time, but the bulk of the work can be done the tool that you know best. And one of the things that I think that, so as a developer, that I really appreciated in Unix was, you know, this concept of kind of hooking, piping tools together. You know, it's very powerful to have a tool that does one job really well and then let you use the other tools to do what they're really good at. And that's one of the sort of ideas, kind of the idea which we want to do with Bravo. I mean, another way of looking at Bravo is kind of like Zapier, but for the front end. You know, let the tools do their complex things and just act as the piece that kind of hooks them together.
That's interesting because I've never thought about, we talk about the modular approach to no-code, which is connecting those tools together with Zapier or Make. But I've never thought about the connection with piping in that won't talk much to the no-coders who listen to this. But I'm also a big Linux fan, and I work a lot with the command line. And then, yeah, it's exactly the same. Was the same with command line.
One of the things that I felt that really hasn't been looked after well in the no-code space is this focus on design. I think there's a lot of tools that generally focused on functionality, well, from my view, focus on functionality. So there's a huge amount of functionality and ability to do a lot of stuff. However, the flexible design is not kept up with that functionality power. And I think what happens is that, you know, certainly these days, the engagement and the expectations of users is that there is a lot of thought and has gone into the design. And I think and all the tools don't give you that ability. You know, there's not as the flexibility as much as you get in the design tool in some of the sort of design pieces of no-code tools. And I think that's probably something that will have to change because, you know, with that design focus, you get the engagement. And, you know, in companies also want to be able to express their brand clearly. You know, they want to have their exact font. They want to have their exact colors in exactly the layout that make them different from other people. And you can't always get that. And I think sometimes there's frustration that we've seen where, you know, a designer has their design and they can't realize it in some of the tools because the flexibility isn't there. And I think that's something that, well, that's one of the things we're trying to address. And I feel there's going to be a pressure in other tools to do something similar at some point.
It's super important. As you said, you know, at Typeform, for instance,
Typeform, in some respects, it was interesting because it was very focused on design, but really I always used to say that Typeform made it really hard to make it look bad. Typeform was very clever in how it set up the options so that it always, yeah, it made you look good, right? It made whatever you're making look good. It made you the superhero. And again, products win when they make you look good in the superhero. And the trouble is if you don't have that design ability, you don't look, I mean, you might be able to functionally be a superhero, but you don't look like one because it looks a bit janky in places.
Yeah.
And I think that first impressions, unfortunately, are very important. And, you know, you need to have that design slickness to go with the functionality slickness.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I think like there are several no-code tools, like let's say Typeform, I could say Glide, or tools that give you constraints to make it hard to, so that what you produce is not good looking.
Yeah.
And then you have tools that are very open, let's say Bubble or Webflow, but then it's very hard to make something that is good looking because you have to not only master the tool, but you have to be a designer. And what I like what you're saying is that, well, if you have to be a designer, you might as well work in the tool you're used to work, Figma or...
Because, I mean, this is your point, right? Effectively, you're making it really hard for the designer. The designer wants to make something look good, but you're constraining him in the tool he uses, so he can't express himself in the way he wants to. So he can't either you limit it and make sure it always looks good, or I think the other option is that you give the design expressiveness to enable the design to make it look good. But if you break one of those, then you end up with the worst of all worlds. So, you know, I think that's where I see that we need to make choices because design is a critical piece. And it's something that I think people need to think about a bit more.
And so right now, designers can use Figma to
is the idea to provide also other tools, let's say, I don't know, Adobe XD or...
plugin. So we do both Figma and Adobe XD.
Okay.
We looked at doing Sketch, but Sketch doesn't seem to be growing, it seems to be shrinking in terms of as much. Mm. I think they've got some catching up to do. I mean, Figma is just going crazy.
Yeah.
And it's a very, and they're, I mean, there are some very smart people there, and it's very clever how they managed to implement like all of the WebGL stuff to make it so fast. I mean, it's incredible. So yeah, I think they're the two things we work with. So we were trying to make it so we have some options there for people. But I mean, we looked at it. It's a bit like the Unix thing, where you looked at it, like, why is the point? What is the point of us building a design tool that's worse than Figma when we can just use that? So let's just leverage that and then focus on our work on the thing, a connection piece. So that, you know, make that as best as possible, rather than having a slightly bad version of everything.
No, you're right. And I think, and I don't know, I'm not a designer, so I don't use Figma. That's one of the reasons I couldn't play so as much as I want with Bravo. But I guess also for the designer to use Bravo after doing his design, he must be pretty strict and organized his layers and everything in a good way. So it's probably also like positive side effect. I don't know, but maybe I'm venturing.
I mean, I don't know if it's positive. I mean, the trouble is whenever you have this sort of process where you're trying to sort of collate their ideas into something that can be turned to an app, we have to have, we've got to do some sort of processing on it. And, you know, I think that's, to be fair, that's one of the pain points we have right now. I mean, you know, we need to be able to, that's the learning of Bravo. It's kind of how do you map? Well, how do you lay out your design so that it works with Bravo? You don't get weird things happening. Because, you know, we want to have the ability to people to work with as many designs as possible. But, you know,
yeah,
it was always this kind of trade-off. So, yeah, there's a little bit of kind of structuring it in a certain way. And I personally would prefer that we didn't have to do that, that we could just take any design and figure out what they're trying to do. But, you know, there's reality hits expectation at that point. So it's a difficult balancing it. But yeah, I mean, it's, I think particularly when you get the hang of it, it's incredibly fast. I mean, the other day someone asked me, we were looking at building an app to provide refugees from Ukraine with legal advice, right? So it was like, okay, how do we do this? And, you know, so I was looking at this company and saying, okay, well, you know, we want to use this chat application and we need to have this login to authenticate them and then take the two together. And, you know, it's like, okay, well, I mean, looking at it, I said, well, we can put the chat application in a web view that we can connect through and then send it the token from the Auth0 to be the authentication provider. And it took about an hour to hook the two together and get done. Yeah, and that's the power of, you know, if with the right set of applications, or as we build in more sort of components to Bravo, the speed just increases in terms of, so long as you know how to put it together. And that's the challenge. If you have that, you know, and not only does it put it together, but it ends up being a very, very nice feeling native application of using these things. So if you do get your head around it, that a little bit of learning, then it is. I don't think there's very few things that are as fast as being able to go from a design to an application than Bravo.
Yeah, no, yeah, probably. And so for the back end side, so because you connect, so you said like Bravo connects the front end with APIs. So I know the first use case was Airtable, obviously.
Yep.
Is the plan to be like kind of generic with APIs, or is it already the case?
It's completely generic. So, I mean, we made it generic from the beginning. We did a wizard for Airtable to be able to kind of figure out, set up some APIs for you. We recently added in the ability to pull in Swagger definitions of APIs so that we can automatically pull in. But, you know, I've done tutorials in Backendless, Xano, Bubble, Webflow. I think we've done some stuff with Azure, AWS. I mean, it's a REST API that connects, sends back JSON. If you've got that, you know, the actual, in the Edge Bravo itself, the way that we call it the API bridge, and basically it's a bit like Postman. So, you know, you put in the URL, you put in the headers, you put in the body or whatever, and then you can set up variables that can be passed through, and then it returns a JSON, which you can then highlight the fields that you want to appear in your application. And so it's pretty straightforward to kind of hook it up, and then, you know, you can then, and what happens is the design will adapt depending on what the data comes back. So imagine you have a list coming back, then you can say to Bravo, okay, this frame, I want to iterate through the design, populating the elements from the actual JSON that's come back. I mean, usually with a few clicks, there's no code involved here. You just basically, this field goes here, which is the beauty of using a tool like Figma. You can just kind of get names together. So it means you end up with a very dynamic application. And then we've added in OAuth2 authentication. We've added in the ability to do notifications with OneSignal. We've added also recently added in localization, so that what happens is we pull out all the text from Figma and allow you to have multiple languages for that text from Figma. So obviously from the API, you can have the text coming back, because we can actually send the language of the phone. So we send the language of the phone, so the API can return back, but we also need to localize for the Figma for definition, because Figma doesn't have that as standard. So so we can add that. I mean, there's a whole ton of stuff that's in Bravo. So you can build pretty complicated applications now just from the design, which is, you know, can be really powerful.
Do you have some examples of apps that were published at... You would be particularly proud of?
Yeah, so it's not so easy to do on a podcast.
Can explain. I can put the links in the notes.
Well, maybe what I'll do is I'll send you some links across. And there's a few on our website. There's a Made with Bravo section which talks through some of the ones I've done. There's some we've just published which really show off the depth of it. I think one of the recent ones was a real estate company in Dubai that uses Bravo, they basically, you know, they bought. I mean, it was an interesting use case because they actually spent $100,000 building an application which they had to throw away, and then they built in Bravo in 2 weeks because they had the back end, they had the designs, and if you have that, Bravo is it's just super fast.
Okay, what would you say, in terms of use cases,
in some respects, Bravo is it's quite a horizontal product, a bit like Typeform. We can use in lots of different areas. We tend to see two distinct user group types of users. We have people who want to prototype, who want to do more than just images, but actually connect it to APIs to kind of connect to their backend systems to pull data in. That works. So that's one big group of users. Then the other group is people who actually want to build things, and they're kind of like split a little bit more into sort of single developers who want to either freelancers or people building something for themselves, or companies that want to build an app for their product. And I think for my mind, that's really where I think Bravo really shines. If you've got a web property, I mean, imagine you've built a bubble application, right? To be able to then say, right, to use Bravo to connect into the APIs of your web property, which are already there, and with a design that's probably already been done by a designer, you get a mobile application really fast. And I think that's something that we're really pushing on, because I think it's such a great win for people. You can get a fully publishable app, and you know, just by hooking those two together.
Yeah, I think it's very important for people to understand how to disconnect kind of like the front end and the back end. They have like this, and it's now we also see on the website all this new set of tools, like WeWeb, for instance, like we also have the same. They only build the front end, they don't do the back end. And so now you can have, okay, one tool, maybe Xano seems to be very popular now for the back end. And then you can have WeWeb for a website, and then you can have Bravo, let's say, for a mobile version.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the benefits of this is it enables make scaling a bit easier. I mean, one of the challenges with a lot of the no-code tools is that they want you to work entirely in their ecosystem, and when you hit certain limitations in terms of speed or size of data or latency, whatever it is, then you need to try to migrate off, and that can be quite hard. But if you've decoupled, I mean, this is a classic thing the developers have always been doing for a long time, decoupling the front and the back end to enable you to have some flexibility. And you know, if you build it from the beginning, you could keep Bravo and scale all the way through, and then just change your back end every time you hit certain limitations, and users wouldn't necessarily have to know any difference at all, because you know, they don't see that difference.
Yeah, you could have backend first that's in no code, but then eventually that's become coded. It doesn't matter as long as you get the API straight.
And from a Bravo's perspective, you know, nothing would change other than maybe get a bit faster because it responds quicker.
Yeah, no, it's do you have any plans? Maybe I'm curious to know a bit about the roadmap, about what you want to say of the roadmap. But any is there any plans to go towards the website, or you just want to keep it mobile?
I think we're trying to tackle mobile first because it's the hardest problem, but we think there's a lot of opportunity for us to do it in different areas. I mean, we haven't done much with web because there's a lot of people in that space already. I mean, I think as we grow and we have people building things for Bravo, then maybe it might make sense for us to do some form of web, because it just the pattern follows. I mean, the pattern works just as well. So possibly that. I think the other thing we want to look at doing is possibly helping people. One of the things I think is super interesting is auto-generating a backend. You know, if you know the design and you can infer, like, this is going to be a list and these are the fields I need to have, you could actually auto-generate the schema and the backend, or at least the CRUD definition of those bits of information from just the design itself. So you could start off with a bare bones framework that could help you to get going. And that's quite interesting as well. Because, you know, I think anything that can help people get set up, you know, one of the challenges we have is people, they don't, you know, they have ideas, but they can't always get to them. And, you know, the faster you can get them going, or the further we can get them down the road of building those things, the better for everybody, really. And I think we want to try and do a bit more with the back end, make the back end easier, because, you know, because that helps get through some of the API issues. APIs is a big learning point for a lot of people. And as well as helping train them up, we also need to think about how we make that easier for people, whether it's working with existing tools like Bubble, making that easier, or it's kind of maybe creating a simple one of our own to help people get started.
Yeah, it reminds me, I don't know, maybe it's not a good parallel, but with the frameworks, like, let's say, like, I don't know, Ruby on Rails framework, then there is a very basic other framework that's called Sinatra, for instance, that only does the API, kind of like the backend. So it's not actually related to Rails, but I feel like, you know, like, Bubble is such a huge thing, and sometimes, you know, you need just a bit that is the database and the API that is like the CRUD, as you said, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like this.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. And I think, you know, people want to have choice and they want to be able to, you know, I think the great thing, APIs is a great leveler because it allows people to kind of pick and choose the things they want to have. But with that comes some complexity of, like, which are the things I should, what are the best things for me to choose, and how do I manage to handle these different tools at the same time? You know, I think that's going to be an increasing complexity that we have to think about. Because, you know, I mean, it may be very well the API is working, but not many tools have management of those APIs through APIs, if you see what I mean.
So, yeah.
If we wanted to say to, let's suppose you want someone who's a Bubble user, right, I want to build a backend from this design. You know, I don't think there's an easy way for me to create the schema in Bubble with APIs.
Yeah. That's interesting. I didn't see this point of, okay, no, I see what you mean.
Well, it goes both ways. I mean, you could almost do it the other way around and say, okay, from a back end, can I auto generate a front end? Right? Can I always space it? I want to expose these things in a list and, you know, here's a design, could I auto generate something? I think, you know, getting people started is helpful. I'm just throwing
it. It's super interesting.
But I think one of the things we're going to see is, you know, alongside is, more APIs is the tools that can kind of expose, allow that the high level connection to happen as well. I think that would be interesting to see.
Yeah, I don't know the Xano enough, but I would say, like, this, do they allow that? No, not yet.
I haven't used it now, so I don't think so.
But they probably should go this way, actually. That sounds very
interesting. I think backendless does a bit. I think that's pretty API driven all the way through. Superbase is a good one that does that.
All right. And it's open source also.
Is it short, sorry?
It's open source, Superbase.
Yeah. Superbase is a collection of, like, projects. As well as a customized thing on top. It's quite nice because it's completely driven from Postgres. So it becomes, you know, if you can connect to Postgres, you can control most of it that way. So yeah, some of these tools, I think there's some interesting things for us to do to kind of leverage some of these tools.
Okay. Yeah, well, we have a bright future ahead of us in terms of...
Interesting. I mean, the challenge is making it the work. I mean, at the end of the day, there's always this classic thing of getting too caught up in what's clever and not focus enough on what provides value to users. I mean, it's all very well doing lots of clever things, but if it doesn't help the users get their job done in a cost-effective or a fast way, then we need to stop doing it, because, you know, that's the important thing. And try to find the sweet spot between, you know, these interesting ideas and something that really helps people. Yeah. That's the magic of when the startups really fly.
Yeah, it's true. And it's tough sometimes for technical people to find this balance, because they're attracted to this, okay, we have this crazy idea, let's do it.
It's one of the things about no-code, because often, you know, most people, a lot of tech people, developers hate no-code because they can't touch the code. They want to build it themselves. You know, don't do this, I'll do much better myself. And, you know, I mean, sometimes that's true, they will, but they probably wouldn't in the same amount of time. You know, I mean, well, the power of no-code is it gives you the ability to get maybe not the best solution, but a good solution very fast. And, you know, that's some of the things that devs are always good at looking at, you know, that those trade-offs. It's very much about what's the optimal from a sort of technical point of view or a efficiency point of view, but not from a sort of overall point of view of providing value. And I think that's an important thing we need to bring in. I think no-code is a great opportunity to help develop products faster and help people get to that value, because often you need to iterate to understand what the true value is. And if you spend a year developing something and find it's wrong, then you waste a lot of time.
Yeah, definitely. This whole MVP philosophy, going like to this, the viable product. And yeah, I think sometimes the constraint of the no-code tools help people, even like non-technical people, also to not build those like Frankenstein products, you know, where I like be like, oh, I can do this and I can do this.
Well, it helps you really focus. There's a great tool in product management, which is kind of what we call MOSCO, right? What are the, and it's a series of acronyms, like what must I have, what should I have, what could I have, and what won't do, right? And so, you know, one of the things about the constraints of no-code is it really helps you, forces you to say, do I really need this? And often you don't. Often it's not the core thing to the product you're making. So things, so often constraints can be helpful. Where it gets tricky is when the constraints actively oppose what you're trying to do. And, you know, there's a core functionality. And, you know, again, this is where I think the silo nature of some no-code tools becomes a problem. I mean, Bubble's quite good because you have the ability to drop code in to work around a lot of problems. I mean, there's some, it's not, Bubble's not super fast. I mean, I think it's one of the things they're working on is make it fast. I did some benchmarking actually, and it was like the worst of all the back end things I looked at. But no offense, Bubbles, but you know,
it's just, it's a fact.
But it's a trade off because it has the flexibility. So I mean, it kind of goes with that. But I think the ability to kind of, you know, use APIs to get something, to provide something with a different, you know, profile of, you know, maybe less functionality but more speed in certain areas, and that can really help. So, you know, using different data stores or faster data stores, you know, and one of the tools I was, the fastest one when I did that comparison was actually Contentful, which was not unsurprising because it's a, you know, it's a dedicated CMS with a nice, you know, using a content delivery network, CDN at the front of it. So it should be really fast.
Yeah.
By definition, it should be really fast. And so trying to be able to use the right tool for the right job, I mean, that's one of the classic things about development, right? You always need to think about what you're trying to do. So, you know, I think it's, there's a lot of things where there's a lot of opportunities and stuff out there for everybody. But I think it's going to be interesting, I would say, over the next couple of years.
Cool. Well, super interesting. We'll be here to follow all this. Just before we finish, two more questions. Just I'm curious to know, as a company and maybe as yourself, what are the other no-code tools that you use for maybe for your operations? Maybe you don't actually.
Well, it's interesting. I think the definition of no-code tools is so wide now because everybody kind of, it's a great bucket of things. Notion is a huge one. We started out, it's funny, we started out, I felt we had to use Jira to help manage tickets and things. And all devs hate Jira pretty much, as far as I'm aware.
But and still everybody uses it.
Well, I mean, we stopped using it because we were able to put the tickets into Notion and it got us, we couldn't quite get the workflows we wanted to have, but to the end of the day, some of the data sort of analysis isn't there, but, and actually with the APIs now, the Notion has, it becomes less relevant. But I mean, it was hugely flexible. So that's a phenomenal one. I like that a lot. Other than Notion, what other no-code tools do we use?
We use it Airtable at all, for instance?
Yes, we use Airtable internally. Actually, one of the things I love, actually, which so one of our clients was using Airtable, but was worried about their 5 requests a second limit because, you know, because, I mean, actually, some of our customers use Airtable in production, which is a bit dangerous because it's not quite what it's for. And I found this great tool. Well, it's a combination, really. So there's a thing called Sequin.io, I don't know if you come across it. Really nice design that basically replicates not only Airtable, but also Notion and Stripe and a bunch of things, and pushes it into a Postgres database. So, you know, that for me is a great combination with Supabase. So by basically connecting Airtable with Sequin to Supabase means that I have a read replica of Airtable with a much better performance, very close behind what the Airtable is doing. And I think that's a great combination for people that want to use Airtable in production but are worried about some of these limits. And Sequin does a really nice job of handling the writes back as well. I mean, it's a really nice setup. And for me, that's quite a nice combination that I think can help people move from super early MVP of Airtable only to something that you want to test with a bunch more users without having to rebuild everything from scratch. So that was a
super interesting.
So yeah, Supabase is another one. So we use a Airtable internally and I use Supabase for a bunch of things. I mean, I've tried a bunch of the different products. I think one of my Supabase is one of my favorites right now. All the documentations could do a bit of work probably on the API side, but there's some good things out there.
Cool. Before we finish, just one last question about Barcelona. Escape the no-code ecosystem. I'm just curious to is it a good city for startups, for tech industry?
So this is almost a topic for a whole nother podcast. My hypotheses is that with the move to remote work, where you work is going to be almost a perk of the job because you don't need to base yourself around other people as much. Well, for those, some people still like it, but for the people, I mean, I think places like Barcelona are great for young people, also families, because it's much more of a family-orientated society in Spain to a degree. So I think we're going to see more people moving to places like Barcelona, or at least if the people want the weather or the environment or whatever. Mm-hmm. They'll move to places where they feel that they want to live. And so you can almost be in a place, you can live in a place where you want to go on holiday because you can remote work. So yes, I mean, that's kind of a longer answer, whereas I think Barcelona is a very good place to start up. Spain is an interesting ecosystem because, unlike a lot of European countries, it has two very big startup scenes, both in Madrid and Barcelona. In fact, unusually for Europe, Barcelona is not the capital city, and yet it's still a very strong startup ecosystem. And what tends to happen, and this is a little bit anecdotal, but what I've seen is that Madrid tends to have a lot of the Spain, Latin American-based startups, whereas Barcelona has more of the international focused startups. I mean, so for example, I think in Madrid, you have things like Cabify, and whereas in Barcelona, you have Typeform, TravelPerk, right? So you kind of have these, that's where it feels the split is. And, you know, I feel like, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for Spain to grow as a startup scene. I wouldn't necessarily do everything here, but I mean, I think recently Facebook has created a big remote working center in Madrid, and it's going to recruit like 2,000 people in Spain, or at least remotely here, because it's a great place to work. And I think that's going to be a trend, because you don't necessarily have to suffer the weather of the northern hemisphere. And coming from the UK, I really feel that.
Okay, super interesting. Do you know if there is a lot of no-coders around in Barcelona and Spain in general?
Not anywhere near there is in France. France is like winning, for sure. I mean, obviously, there's tools like Typeform that are here. There's I think also Arangu is in Galicia. So there's a few thing no-code tools here. Rainbow Studio, I guess, as well, obviously. I don't think there's much of a no-code community here. There's a few places there, but I don't think it's quite as cohesive as France is doing right now. So France is definitely leading, I think, probably.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Yeah, I could see from my research that there is a few small studios, mostly around Bubble, someone, Matt, I meet this afternoon. So I'm curious also to see his perspective. But I could see on Twitter that there are some people, mostly around Bubble for some reason. But I guess maybe I don't say them everywhere, but I don't know why.
For
but
feed.
yeah, maybe also I'm in the Bubble. Yeah, okay, it's interesting. Last question, the really last one. What's your favorite thing to do here in Barcelona?
Well, that's a great question. My favorite thing. Well, actually, I have two, and that's because of what you can do here. So it's not directly in Barcelona, but one of the things that's amazing in Barcelona is you can catch the train. You get a ticket from Plaça Catalunya that will give you a train ticket and ski hire, and you go skiing the mountains in 2 hours. You get a train up there and train back, all for like 70 euros. So skiing just outside Barcelona is not something
that we're expecting.
And it's not what people think about that you can do, but that's in the winter, that's pretty fun. But also going to the beach and being able to go to like the Costa Brava, which is like an hour away, having access to that. And then probably inside the city itself, I just like walking in the big sort of the different ramblers in the streets, and it's just a beautiful city. And it's every time I walk through in the sunny weather, I just feel I'm very lucky to live.
Yeah, well, that's what I did coming here, and it seems like a very walkable city. I mean, there's quite a lot of cars actually, but I mean, I guess maybe also I just don't know the smaller streets, but yeah, the distances and you see a lot.
It's very walkable. The other thing that's quite clever about it is the fact that it tends to go downhill, so you know where the beach is because you can see where the roads go down. But it has a great metro system. It has great buses, and then the public transport here is really good. You can get around really easily. And yeah, I mean, the restaurants, the architecture, there's a lot of things to do.
Yeah.
But it's just the weather and the feel of the place is something that I just love.
Cool. Perfect. Well, thank you so much for all this. It was a very interesting exchange.
Great. Well, thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for listening to this conversation until the end. I hope it wasn't too technical, but I have to say I was super happy to have this chat with Oliver. I really, really appreciate what they're doing at Bravo. I think it's super interesting and I'm super excited to see what's coming next for them. And for me, what's coming next? I'm continuing my trip and I'm heading to the south of Spain. I will go through Cordoba, Sevilla, Faro in Portugal, and eventually end up in Lisbon, where I will have my next episode, and I'm meeting some very interesting people there. I couldn't find anyone in the no-code space in the other countries. There were some interesting people in Spain. Unfortunately, they were not free to meet me, but yeah, I'll be back in Spain. I can see it's a ground of interesting no-coders, so let's see. But for me, time to head back, be on my way in the train, and I'll be with you for the second episode of the season in Lisbon.